Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. This is Sal from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. As a reminder to those who are joining us live, make sure and join us in the chat room at the bottom of the show page. You're one click away from hanging out with the usual suspects. If you have some questions or observations that you want to share, Eagle One will be right and heard in the chat room, and we'll fold in your contributions as we move along. And for those that are new to Midrats or you wanted to catch up on some of the previous editions, you can go on Blog Talk Radio. You can grab hold of the entire archive. Or if you just want to be have it pushed to you automatically, you can subscribe up on iTunes. Now let's get on with the show. For the entire hour today, we have a returning guest, a good friend of the show. We have Mackenzie Eaglin. She's a research fellow for National Security Studies at the Allison Center for Foreign Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation. End of the second quarter, fiscal year 2011. Mackenzie, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And like I kind of said at the intro to the show for my readers on my blog, is so much going on. It's a great time you have on board to get your perspective on some things. But before we dive into some of the headlines and some of the dull but important things that are happening in the Beltway right now, I just wanted to get your take on somebody who knows D.C. very well. You know how lobbying works, and you know how think tanks work and advocacy organizations work. You know, not only you're at Heritage, but you know the ladies and gentlemen at other similar institutions. And a lot of people are concerned with something that's going on in the background. I know we've talked briefly about, and an institution that's been around for the better part of 138 years, the U.S. Naval Institute. And one thing it's always tried to do is to maintain as an independent organization that discusses maritime issues, Navy, Marine Corps, Coast Guard, but also larger issues as well with regard to strategy. And one of the interesting parts of that and what has always created some of the creative friction there is because it's an independent institution, there's a heterodoxy on what you can read in whether it's online publications, its offline publications, or even in its printing house. And in the last year, really, though it's really only broken out in the public in the last few months, the board of directors have decided that they want to turn it and change it completely into an advocacy organization. And there's kind of a fine line between an independent organization and an advocacy organization that is set along the lines of not even a neutral think tank, but a hardcore, this is our position, we're going to push it, we're going to defend it think tank. Just from the perspective of the Beltway and how that works, for the listeners, could you just give a brief perspective on the difference between the two and why it might be of a concern to them one way or the other?
Absolutely. You know, the Heritage Foundation is one of the oldest and largest think tanks in the country. And, you know, we as an institution have grappled with this. We are a nonpartisan 501c3, and we are small donor funded, checks under $1,000. So we're membership based, and our primary audience is Congress. You know, we have a shared conservative sort of ideological position, but that's our makeup. And just recently, actually, Heritage leadership thought through this exact issue. So as an analyst, I am unable to lobby, and nor do I want to, as you might imagine, as working for a public policy institute. But Heritage just wrestled with this question, and the answer they came up with was, we do want to push some issues more directly with members of Congress, again, as our primary audience. And so what Heritage leadership decided was to stand up a separate but affiliated organization that's not a C3, but rather a 501c4 lobbying arm. And that was their answer, as opposed to, you know, fundamentally overhauling the Heritage Foundation as it's existed and changing our roots and our legacy. You know, they decided that they would spin off, basically, a much smaller organization where other people can take the work that we do, and people like me, and then, you know, I say, Congress, you should think about this as a critical issue. I never say, Congress, you should vote for this bill, H.R. 277. And, you know, that's the fine line. We lay it all out there for members and policymakers to think through difficult issues, and I love that part of my job. And I'm glad that there's somebody else and there's a, you know, a firewall separating us on that C4 side. Advocacy is important in Washington because somebody out there is going to fill the message void if you're not there. But how you approach it, it seems to be an issue I think a lot of the USNI members are having. And I can understand, and but like I said, I've been through this recently.
Thanks a lot. It's a confusing and is often emotional because people have a lot invested in long-term organizations. And thanks for taking a couple minutes just to add another, really an external voice to the discussion, and to know that we're not alone in this argument on how you either improve or maintain an organization. Hey, but let's switch over to the topic at hand, and simply because it's what has dominated the news cycle for the last few days. And from the initial view, one wouldn't think that the earthquake in Japan would have defense or national security issues, but I think it really seriously does for two reasons. First of all, regardless of what happens with the nuclear power plants, and the Japanese have some of the best technology in the world. Anybody that saw their skyscrapers in Tokyo know their engineers are good. But a country like Japan, they couldn't get rid of nuclear power if they wanted to, because nuclear power provides electricity, which keeps their economy going. There was a little bit, when we finally got rid of our conventional carriers, there was a little bit of concern when we moved our nuclear-powered aircraft carrier up to Japan. And there's also the controversy about energy security here in the U.S. and how we are to adjust to that concern to keep the import of oil. Nuclear power might be one of those reasons. What are, outside of the humanitarian issues, what do you see as some of the macro, either energy security or potential defense implications of the Japanese earthquake?
Well, I see two macro issues that, you know, big thinkers really need to examine here. The first is, in light of what's happened in Japan and what's going on in the Middle East, including North Africa and Libya, you know, it's just fascinating to watch the dichotomy, you know, the disconnect with members of Congress who are lining up to say, we got to cut defense, everything's on the table, the economy is falling apart. And then, you know, there are very similar amounts of these same types of members who are saying, we've got to send the military and the Navy and the Marine Corps in particular to, you know, patrol the Mediterranean, to help enforce a no-fly zone over Libya, to provide humanitarian assistance and disaster relief in Japan. And don't forget, you know, countering piracy off the coast of Somalia. You know, all of these things that are going on around the world that the U.S. military is involved with, there is just a growing disconnect between reality of what we ask the military to do, what's happening inside of Washington, and how we're going to pay for all of these things we ask men and women in uniform. And then on a separate issue, you know, this really highlights something we've talked about before in the past, Sal, which is, you know, I remember when the Department of Defense proposed one shipyard acquisition strategy for destroyers, major surface combatants, and basically was going to put Bath Iron Works in Maine out of business. And the concern I remember back at the time, my member was pushing with Navy leadership, was that if there were ever a hurricane or a real disaster in, you know, the Gulf region of America, that you would need a backup plan. You need another capability to build that somewhere else. And we were laughed out of the room by Navy leadership at the time, civilian in uniform. And then what happened? Hurricane Katrina came along a few years later. And, you know, we're seeing right now a growing call, again, inside this disconnect. Inside Washington, everyone's saying, you know, abandon ship in terms of overseas basing. We don't need this anymore. You know, we don't need as much significant presence as we've had around the world. We can't afford it. You know, of course, big implications for the Navy. And we're seeing with Japan and Libya, the the whole notion of presence and what does that mean? What is the sovereign, you know, territory that Navy Carrier Strike Group provides you? The whole point about being nearby and in the neighborhood when a crisis strikes, to truly be there a day later as opposed to 2 weeks later. These are, you know, things that we have to think about as we're talking about, you know, our basing in Guam and Japan right now and what we're going to do about that, but also just our overall force structure and, you know, what the future really holds. I think we're seeing too many people sort of assume away a lot of challenges that haven't gone anywhere, and they're all manifesting themselves at once around the world.
Well, can you hear me?
Yes.
Sean?
Okay, good. This is Eagle One. Sorry, I had some technical difficulties early, and I didn't get a chance to test out my phone. It kind of strikes me that we're in one of those almost quasi two major contingencies things that we used to worry about in the Navy and in the Defense Department, especially the Navy, and we're not doing real well with that. Is this because of the cuts you're talking about? And along with that, what damages do you see from the future cuts that we know are on the horizon with respect to the Defense Department?
Sure. Well, you know, I think we exposed ourselves as a nation, you know, that we'd always said we'd had the two major theater war capability or the two war planning construct. And I think that's important for a superpower, even if it's a win-hold-win force planning construct. I'm okay with that. But, Iraq and Afghanistan really exposed that the emperor has no clothes. And, you know, we had to really seed ground in Afghanistan in order to build up in Iraq. And then, of course, we're having to make up for that right now in Afghanistan as we wind down in Iraq. Yet all of those, you know, what we used to call smaller scale or lesser included or other than war operations, the number of those has only been growing exponentially since the wall fell in 1991, and yet we continue to reduce the overall size of the military with some small exceptions for ground force and strength, and it just baffles the mind because we continue to ask the military to do everything. I call it a sort of kitchen sink strategy. We've just thrown everything in there saying, you know, low end to high end, smaller scale to major combat operations. You guys need to do it all, be everywhere, do everything, and you need to do it with less. And sooner or later, there is a tipping point for the military. There is what we call an invisible red line that we will cross, and we will not know we've crossed it, unfortunately, I fear, until after the fact. We can break this all-volunteer force. We've seen the force go hollow. It happened in the 70s, and I'm very concerned about the rhetoric coming out of Washington and the actual dollars to follow in defense right now, because the 2011 budget, I know we're all talking about 2012 and 2013, the Congress is still figuring out how to fund this fiscal year, and it's going to be, the outcome of this will be defense cuts for 3 years thereafter, regardless of the president's budget request for 2012, and that's really, you know, piling on to an already tenuous position for the force that we have.
You hit on something that, you know, when I mentioned before, the dull and boring. I was out in San Diego earlier this year for the West 2011 conference, I heard twice by some active duty general officers present something that caught my ear that I just did not appreciate. And and I think Undersecretary Work actually mentioned this as well while he was there, that one of the most stupid and dangerous things is about to happen. And that's going to be the lack of getting a bill and just living off continuing resolutions until this gets resolved, because bad decisions, inefficient and expensive decisions are going to be made. Could you talk for a second about the implication for long-range material support that these continuing resolutions are going to have for us?
Absolutely. Let's start sort of from taking a step back. The continuing resolution is a problem, you know, operating under either a short-term CR or a series of them or even a long-term one through the end of the year. It's a real problem for the military, unlike any other federal agency, because of the policy restrictions therein, which means you can't start new production on a program, so like, say, for the Air Force, a next-generation bomber. And for the Navy, you can't expand existing programs, so that would include the Virginia-class submarine, DDG-51, going from both of those from one to two per year, as well as possibly the littoral combat ship. So that's the problem with the CR practically, which is pretty significant. We're talking over a dozen major acquisition programs for the Navy affected by that. But then the other problem with the CR and or funding defense, even if we get a bill passed in 2011, is the funding levels proposed by Congress. They are so inadequate. We are gone way past muscle and into bone here. The Congress right now, at best case scenario, whether or not they fund defense through a CR or a 2011 appropriations bill, we're looking at a $20 to $25 billion reduction from what the president asked for this fiscal year, meaning what the Navy and all the services were planning to receive, right? And what that means, so that creates 3 years of ripple effect problems for the Navy. It rebaselines a lower budget in 2012 for the Navy, and everything's going to be upended as a result of that. It reduces the buying power of all of the services. But then you have a practical immediate effect, where you have program managers who aren't going to let out contract bids until they have the cash in hand from Uncle Sam. But with all of the uncertainty about where the money is right now, you're going to create a bow wave of spending at the end of the year because everyone's going to defer their programs and projects. And then the system cannot fully absorb that, so then they will not be able to spend all of the money, and then what happens? We've seen this 1,000 times. If a program schedule slips for whatever reason, in this case Congress, then the overall buy is cut, and then, as you know, this is a vicious cycle that continues. And the Navy has been the most vocal in talking about the real-world consequences of what Congress is doing right now. And I think this is very important for your listeners to understand, because when I hear there's so much waste in the defense budget for members of Congress who haven't really gone through every line item, the impact of the CR, which is just, like I said, a $20 to $25 billion delta, just shows that there are no $600 hammers at the Pentagon budget anymore. The Navy is having to reduce its PCS notification time for sailors, that's usually a 4 to 6 month process, down to 2 because of lack of funding. The Navy is no longer going to send sailors to Europe as planned as a result of everything happening right now. They're slowing the pace of security clearances that they've issued. They're neglecting maintenance on the shore. 5 availabilities planned for April and May have been canceled. Over 20 Navy projects, shoreside projects, have been deferred. 2 availabilities underway have been scrapped altogether. Training for sailors and shipyard repair work is all being, again, either canceled completely or deferred indefinitely. The mobile landing platform for the Marine Corps is going to be halted. I mean, you guys, this is only the tip of the iceberg that I'm laying out. There are so many more things. Just this week, the CNO told Congress 10,000 jobs are at risk in the Department of the Navy based on what's happening.
But before I hand it over to Eagle One, Mackenzie, what you just outlined there, the serious implications, is that summarized anywhere handily? I mean, did the CNO, can you get that text from his, if that was part of his testimony?
You know, I've put this all together at heritage.org in a paper where I sampled all of the services and what the chiefs have been saying and, you know, the impact, because the Air Force is really being hammered as well as the Army. I mean, we're talking upgrades for Apaches and replacement Chinooks for Army brigades in Afghanistan right now that cannot get that, and the Air Force trying to double the MQ-9 Reaper drone purchase for Afghanistan, again, grounding F-15s because they're not getting the upgrades. I mean, this is pretty serious, and I have it at a paper under my name at heritage.org.
Beautiful. Eagle One.
Yeah, one of the other things you have in a paper that you have on heritage.org was a memo you wrote on dated February 3rd, which had to do with the number of non-defense items or quasi-defense items that are folded in the defense budget that you suggest ought to be belong to other departments in the U.S. government. Can you talk about that paper and what those 6 or more programs are that ought to be farmed out and let defense money go to defense projects?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, you know, in the fiscal climate that we're all working in right now, including the Department of Defense, you know, everybody has to take a scalpel to their federal agency or their department and, you know, examine each program and determine on its merit whether it should stay or go. And, you know, I don't think DOD should shy away from this, because pretty much everything will survive that kind of a scrupulous review. And, you know, it's about separating the wheat from the chaff here. And DOD has, you know, free riders. Some members of Congress have been throwing things in the defense bill for years as its funding was rising, and they don't belong in the defense budget. But yet, you know, the Army and the Navy, particularly the R&D accounts, research and development, they've been having to fund earmarks for cargo container security that really need to be done over at the Department of Homeland Security and elsewhere. The National Guard eradicating marijuana from forests here in the United States. Things like this that are, you know, in the defense bill that could either be funded elsewhere or, frankly, just eliminated altogether, because everybody should agree on one thing. We might disagree on what in the budget might need to be funded elsewhere, and that's something for elected officials to decide. But what we can agree on is that the modernization accounts in the DOD budget and the Navy's budget need to grow. That's something that, you know, Gates started over a year ago, and, you know, to get, if we're ever lucky, over a 300-ship Navy for starters, and, you know, buying out the JSF purchase, we're going to need to grow modernization more than 1% per year, and that's the projection right now, meaning the procurement accounts and the hardware, the iron. And we've got to go through the defense bill, and we've got to free up this money. And like I said, I don't think anybody needs to shy away from this in the department. I think it's a good thing. We can all embrace this.
The another big story here recently, and I think it's been really interesting to watch from a former planner's perspective, has been the operations off of Libya. And as you know, with anything that happens around the world, there are three things that you really need to go into it: whether there's a desire to do something about it, an ability to do it, and then, of course, you have to have the commander's intent in order to execute it. And the Enterprise is doing what it does over in the Red Sea. And the interesting thing to see, especially on the 10th, when President Sarkozy of France came out in support of a no-fly zone, we also saw the Arab League come out and say, we want to do a no-fly zone. The week before, Prime Minister Cameron came out and said, we want to do a no-fly zone. That's all nice from their perspective, and the old cooperative maritime partnership comes into play here too. The Brits have gotten rid of, they've decommed the Ark Royal, they've gotten rid of all their shipborne Harriers, so they cannot do counter air from the sea. The French have the Charles de Gaulle, who I believe has 35 air-to-air capable aircraft, but as anybody knows, if, with carrier planes, that's not even really a big deck carrier. That's only good for a few days. We bounced around a few ideas that if you wanted to do one from a U.S. perspective, you know, we have the Enterprise, but one carrier can't do it. You need at least two with some tanker support, sure, but ideally, if you want to do a serious one, four. And I think SecDef Gate put some real serious things on the table that if you want to do this, other things need to take place. With the inertia that we have, do you really think that outside of the U.S. doing 90% of the lifting, if there's any ability, if a commander said, yes, we can do a fly zone, could the Europeans or the Arab League in any way get together to do anything, or for the international community, is doing something Uncle Sam doing it?
That's a great point. Let me go back to one of the first things you said, Commander Salamander, which is that several first order questions have not been addressed about the no-fly zone, which is why I think you see so much reticence on the Department of Defense side. You know, who, what, when, where, why, those sort of basic ones about that precede the question of how to do a no-fly zone, including what is America's desired end state and our vital national interest therein. I mean, if we cannot figure out what the primary purpose of this is, then we don't even know the assets required to achieve that mission. So, you know, would it be to protect civilians? Would it facilitate the delivery of humanitarian assistance? Or is this part of a larger effort at regime change, which would involve significantly more assets? And what's often not talked about, which is what you're raising as part of the second piece of your question, is the opportunity cost of establishing a no-fly zone. Specifically, you know, what Department of Navy and Air Force capabilities would be required, and where would they be diverted from, if anywhere? You know, is this surge capacity, or are we taking, like we did for Afghanistan, from Afghanistan to Haiti for relief, are we borrowing things that we need there to send somewhere else to another theater? So, you know, these are important, and I'm glad you raised that. as far as everyone coming together to do this, is there the capability somewhere else in the world? And even if there is, will the U.S. probably end up doing the majority of the work? I think the foot dragging in terms of implementing action beyond words is a perfect example of what's really going on here, that many nations, particularly in Europe, lack the capability to do this, to even get started. And, you know, we've seen this trend in NATO countries for the last 10 years. Most of them have been slashing defense budgets and in the name of cost savings, and now we're seeing what, again, they really don't have this kind of capability. And, you know, the Arab League, I traveled to the Middle East a couple of years ago, and they have pretty decent overall air capability in the region. We're not talking F-22, you know, where they can just fly with impunity. But, you know, I don't know why they're not taking more aggressive action. If this ultimately happens, I think you are correct in your, I assume, which was your assumption, the U.S. will bear the majority of the burden for that mission.
Speaking of missions that we seem to bear the majority of, I mean, we've now sent a carrier, I think a couple of other flat deck amphibious ships and several destroyers off the coast of Japan to help with their tsunami and earthquake issues. Is this another unfunded requirement from the Navy, or is this something that we ought to be foisting off on the Department of State as a cost item?
Well, you know, it's both, which is, I know, a classic D.C. answer. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense have been pushing the last couple of years in their posture hearings on the Hill for Congress to approve increases in State Department capabilities, and they're talking about specific ones that really augment or complement DOD capacity in places like Iraq, Afghanistan, and where we're doing a lot of humanitarian assistance, development, and aid work, and that sort of thing that, of course, we've been asking the military to do. For example, the provincial reconstruction team work in Afghanistan, DOD has been carrying the burden of that when state and AID need to be doing the work. And Congress continues to not agree with funding increases for the State Department, and it is really frustrating, and I can understand why the Secretary of State and others are frustrated, because, again, we see this classic chasing our tail, chicken and egg problem. The military is begging for help from, you know, the civilian assets of the U.S. government, and Congress is saying we need to ask the military to do less because, you know, we're probably going to take money from it anyway, and yet we're not raising up civilian tools of power to support all of these, you know, increasing demands around the world. So, again, what ends up happening is the military just does more and more and more with less, and this trend is reaching a crisis point. And, you know, the Secretary has been talking about it lately, but unfortunately I think he's too late to the game. You know, this is the same Secretary of Defense 2 years ago that, you know, really cut a lot of important plans and programs for the Navy and the Air Force. And, you know, if he didn't cut them, he deferred them indefinitely or until maybe next year or the FYDP, which was, you know, we all know monopoly money. And those chickens are really coming home to roost, and that's what we're going to see is more of this. You know, a couple of years ago, the commander of the surface fleet had to take an entire pause for the U.S. Navy to examine the readiness of our ships. And, you know, we can only patch up Band-Aids with Band-Aids for so long, and sooner or later something's going to give.
Yeah, speaking of things that we're going to give, I'm in the middle right now of an audiobook of Rumsfeld's, which, by the way, I recommend to everybody, if you're going to get Rumsfeld's book as opposed to reading it, get it as audiobook. You got to give Rummy some credit. He is the narrator of his audiobook, so you spend hours and hours and hours with Donald Rumsfeld as he reads his book to you. Very interesting to drive around with him. But one thing that he talks about in the part of the book right before he gets to 9/11, he talks about when he came into the SecDef's office, that he looked at Navy shipbuilding, and he was very concerned coming off the lean years of the 1990s where the long-term trends were in shipbuilding. And at that point, if it serves me right, he was looking at about 328. He looked at the age of the ships, the lack of maintenance. You know, you mentioned the availabilities that have been cut. I know that Gunson Hall was one of those ships that got their availability cut, and boy, they need some help in the yards among some other ships. But, you know, 9/11 changed all that. And one thing we talked about when you were here last that I've heard a couple of rumblings in the newspapers again is if you look at the shipbuilding budget, when we come up to 2020, we're going to have to recapitalize our SSBN force. And there's more and more discussion of trying to find a way politically to recapitalize that outside of the shipbuilding budget because it is a strategic asset. Have you heard more about that possibility, or do we need to seriously look at coming up on 2020 having almost all of our shipbuilding money going towards recapitalizing the SSBN force and the second and third order effects that would have?
I have heard that possibility floating around Washington, and you know, it's smart. I mean, it would be great if it worked out that way. But here's the problem. If it doesn't, then what? And we cannot have current and even the next Navy leadership banking on that option. You know, Gates has got one foot out the door. We don't know who's next. We don't know who the next president is. To hope with an insurance policy that this is going to work would be silly. So I think the Navy, I mean, just numbers, just even from a bean counting perspective, they need to plan on that being in the SCN account. And if it really is going to be this huge, massive bill that it's going to be, what in the heck are we going to do? Because the Navy cannot afford to just stop building everything else. You know, I was actually pleased with the President's 12 budget submission for shipbuilding. It was a great leap forward relative to the last few years, but it's still not enough, and it's definitely not going to be enough if the SSBNX just, you know, sucks all the air out of the room, so to speak, in terms of money. Right now, the Navy, I mean, it can't be all or nothing. And what we're seeing in defense in general across the services is a zero-sum game. And I don't want the leadership to let that happen. And now is the time to prepare, not 5 years from now.
What's the we have all these programs, some of which are popular, some of not, like the LCS and DDG 1000 or whatever the Zumwalt class is going to be, or whatever they call it nowadays. What's the future for those as we plug along with these continuing resolutions and or slashes in defense spending?
Well, actually, the Zumwalt looks okay right now, even under the CR right now. I've asked about that recently. But, you know, the Virginia-class submarine, the DDG-51 Arleigh Burke, and the Littoral Combat Ship, each of these programs wants to expand this year, this fiscal year, the one we're operating in right now. The Navy leadership has asked for that to happen. And they are all at risk and under threat, not only of not achieving an increased production rate, which will reduce the cost of these platforms, which is great for the taxpayer, but by not growing this year as planned, that is going to disrupt each one of these programs and cause schedule slips, cost overruns, and overall buy reductions, you know, in the next 2 to 3 years overall. I think it was Ashton Carter who said recently, running the department like this and having these implications for major programs like Virginia-class, LCS, and DDG-51 isn't inefficient. It's anti-efficient. And Congress is so focused on what they think are short-term savings. We're going to cut defense by $20 billion relative to what you had thought you might receive this year. But what could happen is we end up spending $50 billion over the next 3 to make up for these really short-sighted decisions. And there really is a lack of awareness by too many members on the Hill that are letting these really poor policy decisions become reality.
I think as the habit is in many things when it comes to personnel policy that the military may be a guinea pig. And I think most of us have seen on the local level and the state level as you examine long-term costs and sustainability of it, that it's the retirement and medical care benefits that are increasingly absorbing all the money that might be available to do other things. And the one question I've enjoyed asking, simply because I get a lot of blinking eyes and people don't want to talk about it, is when this crunch comes at the federal level, the federal civilian employees will be a very difficult battle compared to what the military might be. And I think one thing that is coming down the road is if you got to cut the cost. In the Navy, they tried to do optimal manning to cut personnel cost, and that turned out to cost more money in maintaining ships. So we moved, I believe it was 6,000 from shore back to sea, so we're trying to fix that. But if you look at the European militaries, many of them, you don't retire at age 42 and get your benefits. You have to wait till you're in your 50s or in some countries into your 60s. And there's also the health care problems going to ask for more contributions from people. Have you seen a conversation in D.C. that's been looking in that direction about changing military retirement, changing retiree health cares, and how that might come out with the budget crunches that are unquestionably going to be coming sooner more than later?
This has been a conversation only among, you know, some think tank people and others, very quietly in hushed tones for the last couple of years. And it just exploded into the open maybe in the last 6 months because of, you know, the impact of, frankly, just the ongoing recession and DOD's contribution to deficit reduction. We all know that, you know, the Secretary wanted to find $100 billion in savings, of which about two-thirds of that would go back to the services. And then the White House came back and said, and we need another $78 billion over the next 5 years from DOD. Now, my concern, just foremost, is that I don't see any other federal agency contributing that amount of money to, you know, the spending problem that Washington has. So that's worrisome that the trend is to go to defense first. But beyond that, it has forced into the open this conversation about management DOD personnel management policies. And I think it's a great conversation to have. 4 out of 5 people in uniform do not serve a full career. And the incentives and the compensation, whether that's cash deferred or in kind, so whether that is a bonus or health care benefits or retirement or education or something else, all of these things are compensation. And, you know, if I'm 18 or 22 or even 26, I typically will want different things. If I know I'm not going to make a career in the military, I will want more cash up front, for example, and I will expect that my benefits are portable, that I can move around my 401k equivalent across employers, whether that's the federal government or, you know, Google. And I think that's a reasonable thing to, you know, want to give a highly mobile youth workforce, which, as you guys know, is a very small pool of people who are eligible to serve at all in the military today, in the enlisted ranks. So that's a good conversation to have. But then just sort of bigger picture about the retirement age and everything else. I mean, at the end of the day, TRICARE for Life, for example, you know, the premiums have not been increased in 15 years. And so I think it's reasonable to have a conversation about why you serve and what the nation owes you as somebody who has been selfless and given the country more than, you know, in some cases, we can give back. It's not something that unfortunately, too many members of Congress just have a knee-jerk reaction. And I think part of that is a noble reason, because using the all-volunteer force for 10 years at war is just an experiment. None of the three of us know how this is going to turn out, and we could break the force. We don't know, and I'm not sure that we are doing enough or that we're following the signs of distress closely enough right now. And they're growing in number, I would argue. We looked at this as part of the QDR independent panel last summer, and the trend lines are very worrisome in terms of the health of the all-volunteer force. But then, you know, more broadly speaking, just the Navy. The CNO has said a couple of years ago, we tried this in 2005, 2006. We knew we needed more money for shipbuilding, so we shrunk the force, and for other reasons as well. The Navy shrank by 16% in overall end strength. I believe this was active duty. The cost of that smaller force during that time grew by 13%. That is an unsustainable situation, because when you have flat defense budgets and exponential growth in your personnel accounts, pretty soon you're going to have to just simply cut end strength, because we've already given up most of the modernization priorities for a lot of the services or deferred them indefinitely. Pretty soon there's no other account left beyond readiness and then personnel. And that's not a good policy solution. It's just more pain, no gain. Instead, let's just figure out how to do this better.
Yeah, I think it's almost something, Mackenzie, that just like it took Nixon to go to China, I think it's going to take some representatives and some senators who have a military background. They're going to have to bring this topic up, because you do see some members of Congress who have not served. They're almost self-conscious about approaching the subject, whereas I think somebody like, you know, Representative West or Senator Brown, who do have a military background, either active duty or reserves, they've got enough street cred, so to speak, that they could start a hard conversation that just might be difficult for other members of Congress to make.
Absolutely. In fact, this is something Congressman Hunter has talked about. He's a Marine and others. And, you know, again, I've been talking about this with members for years, and this is the first time in, 5 years that I can think that members are now initiating this conversation. Granted, they are only dipping their toe in the water, and it's really on a philosophical level at this point. But they understand that, you know, what's happening in the overall American economy is the same types of problems facing DOD. Healthcare is the single largest cost driver in the personnel accounts for DOD, for example, because of many of the same reasons that other people's healthcare, you know, costs are going up, and employer healthcare costs and premiums and everything else. So, you know, it's about, you know, DOD is a petri dish in many ways for a lot of the national problems. And what we don't want to happen in DOD is what's happening with the big three entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Just, you know, if we just put those puppies on autopilot from now, you know, in perpetuity, they will absorb every federal dollar, all of taxpayer revenue, even if you got rid of the entire military. In fact, assuming you did, that's not a solvent system. It's a Ponzi scheme. And DOD has to tackle these same problems and figure out how you have a healthy force, both in terms of maintaining your high-quality professional warrior class and giving them all of the, you know, next generation tools that they can use to sustain military primacy. I mean, on the hardware side here, you can't just have the greatest people in the world. You have to give them the greatest equipment. And, you know, the scales here have been tipping too far on the personnel side, and we need to achieve a balance.
Absolutely. Eagle One.
Yeah, you know, ironically, I'm sitting here looking at a bunch of these things, and of course, being an older retiree myself, I'm curious as to why we have all these different systems to treat people who have served in the military. The VA system, which somebody funds, and I don't think it comes out of DOD funding. We've got retiree benefits and through TRICARE, and then at age 65, I'm going to roll over into Medicare with TRICARE for life as a supplement. But you know, that there's a cost to me in that. That's not a free ride. It's the only free ride as a reservist I had was the 5 years, if you will, between when I turned 60 and I turned 65. You know, I'm a little fuzzy on where these high costs come from, and how many people who of the 20% who actually stay on to retire, how many of those people are driving this cost of medical problems, and what are we doing with these other systems? Why are we not, you know, is the VA system something we can use for these retired military people, which gets them out of the DOD system? And then I also have some questions about pre-funding a lot of these retirement plans. I know when I'm working for a private company, they're in fact, and not in theory, depositing a certain amount of money on my behalf into an account, which when I turn 65, I'm able to get my pension from them based on that deposit. And that's guaranteed by the Pension Benefit Guarantee Plan, which, of course, is guaranteed by the solvency of the United States government, which makes me worry. But, you know, why are we not funding a lot of these plans early on in the career? A guy joins the Navy, you'd think that there would be some, you know, 20 grand or something put aside at that point, and then some contribution every month that funds him without having to take it out of current dollars. It's always current money rather than money that should have been put aside 20 years ago when he joined in. So, random thought, what do you think about that stuff?
Well, you know, I think that you've asked a lot of the questions that, one, show the breadth of how difficult it is to tackle this. I mean, you know, we could just take pay and allowance, you know, on the cash side and bonus side, and put a commission towards the studying of that, and then much less retirement, healthcare, and education benefits, which are really the big three deferred and in-kind benefits that those in uniform receive. And, you know, we are talking about something that I can't even begin to put my arms around. So I agree. And there are so many separate funding streams for military and defense personnel, including civilians. So, you know, when you look at the DoD budget, for example, you take a big a step back or four, you know, major accounts, military personnel, R&D, procurement, and O&M, the readiness account. Well, the military personnel account is not what we spend on people, because what we spend on people is, bleeds into many other accounts in the department, including particularly the operations and maintenance account, and as you raise, other federal agencies are also for helping float a lot of this, including what we pay into the Treasury for select personnel for those long-term benefit costs. And so we, the first problem, can you imagine how members of Congress, no wonder they're not tackling it, GAO reported that the government cannot even identify how much we're spending on military personnel. And they found a minimum of 12 funding lines, and they estimated roughly, and this was in 2005, that the average cost per capita of an active duty service member from E1 to O10 is $125,000 per person per year to Uncle Sam. That's a lot of money. And the growth from 1999 to 05, if you project that forward to this year, fiscal year 2011, if we stayed on that same track, which we probably did, we're looking at about $150,000. Now, no, that doesn't mean that's what, you know, a private first class is making. No. But what it means is the, you know, the average cost of everyone in uniform to the government because of all of those deferred and in-kind benefits, accumulating whether that's somebody who's already left the service and we didn't fully fund that account, or somebody that's joining today and, you know, we need to project forward what that's going to cost. That's a very expensive force. It's worth it in many ways, but it's also, like I said, it's the problem is that it's unsustainable given budget projections. The recession threw a double whammy on top of these challenges, and again, is which why I think it's really spilled into the open. What we saw after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and everything spiraling out of control a couple of years ago was that a lot of employers started scaling back, if not cutting benefits, for their private sector employees. And so you had a lot of healthy retirees jumping back into the military healthcare system. You know, in many ways, DoD's healthcare is considered the gold standard, particularly TRICARE, as we've been talking about. And I can understand the attractiveness, but the system had not anticipated this many people returning, and I'm not convinced, you know, financially that it was able to handle it the best, which is why we've seen, I think, a lot of cost growth in the last 5 years in particular in healthcare. So there are so many challenges. I mean, this is such a big problem. It's exactly why the QDR independent panel, these 20 graybeards and whiz kids, basically what they said to Congress was, no one person can tackle this. You got to stand up, not a congressional commission, because we all know there's too many of those, but a presidential-level commission, much like the stature of the Gates Commission in the early 70s that recommended to President Nixon to abolish the draft and stand up an all-volunteer force. And it was very controversial at the time. But it required, you know, this outside massive analysis of challenging and complex issues and the stature of people appointed by the president to really start to move the ball forward. Because right now we're only talking about it. Next we're going to need to start taking some action. And I don't know that we can get there from here with this Congress, you know, and even in this fiscal environment. But you're asking the right questions, and now we need to find some answers.
I think you're exactly right. It's going to require presidential leadership, presidential direction, and presidential desire. And I don't think Congress is going to be able to do it on itself. And maybe you'll have to wait for a different president to do it. But every year, the problem gets worse and worse and worse and worse. Backing up from personnel for a minute, a fun thing to talk about, because it's always conceptual, but it's important because concepts and strategy help drive what you're actually going to buy down the road. But as we decouple from Iraq, and it looks like the trend is going to continue towards finding some way to extract ourselves from Afghanistan, the discussion of the airland battle concept you can read about in the background. And I've always been drawn to it, not just because I'm have a naval background, but when you look at the natural advantage that we have of oceans and space, which of course buy you time, and our technology, and at least an industrial baseline to give us the ability to have global reach. If you were looking for a direction to go towards, it would be in that air land battle concept, which I think needs a new name, but it really is, you know, base at home, narrow focused, forward deployed, but really a global reach capability. Sectef Gates talks about that a fair bit. Who do you see really being some of the top advocates for this concept? And is there anybody on the Hill that we could expect to come to the front, as I think this conversation is going to come to the fore when people aren't talking about budget problems?
Well, in the last 4 years, you know, defense has really, like we've been talking about, has really taken a lot of hits, and started with really the 2010 budget, you know, where the secretary sort of rebalanced investments towards Iraq and Afghanistan, which really meant taking a lot of money from the Navy and the Air Force and you know, focusing it on the other priorities, and some internal to the Navy, but, you know, some giving it to the Army and the Marine Corps. And what we're seeing now is that was sort of, in his eyes, I think, you know, some of the low-hanging fruit. It was not, and I really would argue you have to do it all. But the fact that the secretary has come all the way around, gone through the entire budget, and now is proposing end strength cuts potentially as part of, you know, the 2014 time frame when we do extract from Afghanistan in a big way, I don't think entirely, just shows that there really is nowhere else to go in the defense budget to find sort of savings, so to speak, to reinvest or reprioritize. And in the meantime, what we've seen is the demand for naval assets in particular has only grown. It never stopped, even when the budgets were sort of reflecting a shift in another direction. And, you know, in many ways, Libya and Japan and other, you know, Somalia and other operations around the world have shown this. And the good news is, of all of the services that have, you know, now, of course, the Army and Marine Corps are included in this, the Navy has had the best advocacy on the Hill. It's been the best from a bipartisan perspective, and it's been the best even from the sort of outside thinkers, thinkocracy, so to speak. Sea power is just, you know, and you hear this from the secretary, that sea power is an investment that the nation requires and it demands, and it needs a sustained investment. And like I said, if you look at the 12 budget, I'd argue no one's really a winner because it's a declining budget, but the Navy is coming out much better than I had anticipated, which is a relief. And I think because even the secretary knows and has finally starting to become a true believer in the value of sea power, that it, you know, it goes much beyond the sort of dot mil domain that we all operate in. So the good news is, you know, Congress has been there for a while, but they really needed, you know, Congress tinkers at the margin with the budget. Let's be honest. They needed the CNO and the SECF to send over the kind of budget we're looking at for 12. And they can get behind that. You know, the QDR independent panel said, look, you got to invest in, you know, all of these naval and air capabilities that are about to atrophy, long-range strike and space and cyber and shipbuilding, including, you know, submarines and destroyers and next-gen cruiser and all these things. The will, thankfully, is there. And, you know, the Navy is poised to be in the best shape going forward, even if Gates were to leave tomorrow, which I do think it will be this year, once and for all, that he departs, which could be a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But what the Navy right now is in the best shape with the work that it's been doing behind the scenes. It's not the best scenario because of things like we've talked about, the SSBNX included, the fact that we still aren't even going to talk about a next-generation cruiser. But where we are today in the financial, you know, problems facing the department, the Navy's in good shape, relatively speaking, and I'm optimistic, and I don't normally say that, going forward for the Navy.
What, when we talk about being optimistic, though, I mean, what are we still in the mode of fewer, more capable ships, or are we actually beginning to talk some serious numbers where we get the number of ships up so that we can actually meet some of the commitments the many commitments we have.
Well, we're starting to talk about that fact that numbers matter. You know, Sea Power Advocates have, like yourselves and those who listen to you, have long been saying, hey, these capabilities are great, but, you know, this next revolution in military affairs or whatever it is it for a service with mission sets like the Department of the Navy, where one ship can only be in one place at one time in any given day around the world? What we're quickly learning, like, for example, with the 7th Fleet, is that presence matters. This isn't just about, you know, air-sea battle and you know, what's required for the future, but today, right now, presence matters. And yes, anti-access area ground, all of these challenges, anti-submarine warfare, all of these challenges are growing, the ballistic missile defense mission set including. So, but the need for presence, I think, had really gotten lost in the debate. It was kind of sure, they'll always be there. We have this great Navy, and they can do it anything we ask. We're seeing this, the opportunity cost of a shrinking Navy. So I guess to both of your questions, it's the talk is starting to sound right. I think we finally turned that corner where presence matters, which means numbers matter, not just capabilities. But the budgets have yet to follow. 12 is a great start. You know, what concerned me before this year's budget was that the last year couple of budgets, they were great in terms of, you know, overall buy, but they were buying 6, 7, 8 ships a year, and they were really what we would call the low-end ships. And that was concerning because the Navy needs to be buying a mix of high and low-end. And so 12 is a step in the right direction, but I am a natural skeptic here in Washington, and having been here long enough that, you know, actions speak louder than word and money talks. And so if we can sustain the FYDP, you know, what the department is planning right now throughout the next 5 years, that would be, you know, when I can say affirmatively, yes, we've come out of the woods. But right now, bottom line is, we're still building maybe a 220-ship Navy. When you project forward, you know, the last five-year Navy budgets, the number of ships and the SCN account, and you just project it forward. This is something Eric Labs at CBO does all the time. We're not looking good for the long term. And I'm just happy with a growing awareness of the problem, and I'll take that right now.
I think you nailed it right there, and there are some of the people in the audience that owe me more beers because I've been saying for a few years, and I understand it's a very difficult position that the CNO is in, but there's a credibility issue in front of Congress that really got bad about 18 months ago with the 313, and anybody can see that the money is just not there, and we're going towards 220. And I think that's got to inform, you know, we've got to have an adult conversation in the maritime community and say, how do we make this happen with this number of ships and this type of capability for the foreseeable future? And we've got to have COA 1, COA 2, and COA 3. A lot of that has to be around that SSBNX. How is that going to work? How do these cuts take place? Because as you can build up an army relatively fast, but you can't build 50 ships overnight anymore. It just doesn't work that way. Before we get all wound up here, Mackenzie, could take a minute. Could you tell us what are you and Heritage working on right now? And for the rest of the calendar year of 2011, what would you want people to start thinking about and focusing on, and where that conversation may take us?
Sure. Well, the first quarter of the year, we've really been responding to members of Congress. You know, I meet with them every single day, all parties, all levels of leadership in both chambers. And we've really been trying to answer the mail on what's in the defense budget that shouldn't be there, as Eagle Speak raised, and how do you save money in defense, you know, and reprioritize, find money for modernization is really what we're trying to do here. At least that's been what I've been telling Congress. You can find all the savings in defense that you want, but you better reinvest it if you look at what you're asking the military to do. So we've been helping answer these questions. You know, the savings one is much more structural. You can't just kill every weapons program and expect to save money, because at the end of the day, 90% of these requirements do not go away. You've only moved that schedule to the right. You have to give, you know, the Marines an amphibious combat vehicle. You call it whatever you want, but they need something. You have to give the Army tracked and wheeled vehicles. It just, you know, these things don't go away. So That's been the first quarter. Now, what are we working on going forward? It's a great question. I'm glad you asked. First off, the House leadership on the House Armed Services Committee and others have asked Heritage to work on, they call it a threat assessment, but I'm going to tell you what I call it. It's really a common sense force structure. So, you know, we sort of, this is very linear. This is not a scenario-based project. It's simple and it's to the point. We looked around the world at the major regions and missions of the military, including strategic forces and missile defense and defending the homeland, and said, this is the world that we live in as it is today. Here are the capabilities required to, you know, defend it. Our interests around the world, our vital interests. We're leaving out a lot of different things. And here's what it costs. And, of course, you know, having worked on, I told you guys, the QDR Independent Panel last summer, they did all this work. And what they found was modernization needs to grow, and naval and air capabilities in particular need to grow, and I've already laid those out. They did all the work. We came out at roughly the same place, but, you know, this is a document that members need because actually what this is a healthy conversation. They're asking for an alternative to the Department of Defense, just sort of, well, this is the 12 budget, okay. You know, that's their answer to everything. And members want more than that. They want an alternative viewpoint. And then the second paper series I'm working on is what I'm calling America Without Armed Forces. And my first paper will be a Sea Power paper with Brian McGrath. And basically where we, you know, take a dramatic scenario where the Navy is a Royal Navy, a mere shadow of its former self in a relatively short amount of time. It is a purely hypothetical scenario. But basically what happens to the nation as a result of, you know, were the U.S. to go the way of the U.K., and particularly the U.S. Navy, and what are the implications, both foreign policy, practically, domestically, militarily, and every other which way. And I hope you'll be looking for that. And maybe once it's out, I'll come back on for 10 minutes and preview.
Well, I like that idea because we've had Brian on a couple of times, and one even as a co-host. So that might be a great show in and to itself, is let Eagle One and I chew on that paper and come back, because we really look forward to having you back, Mackenzie. Thank you very much in all your travels and bothering the folks up on the Hill to take some time with us this Sunday to talk.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Great show as always, and I want to thank everybody that joined us live and in the chat room. Hope everybody has a great spring and a great Navy Day.
Thank you, Mackenzie.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary.
Goodbye, Piccadilly, farewell, let us swear.
It's a long, long way to Tipperary, but my heart's right there.